the Earth moves closer to the sun every year. We have more people. You know, humans have warm bodies. So is heat coming off? We're just going through a lot of change, but I think we are, as a society, doing the best we can.
It's Thursday, August 17th, 2017. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I usually talk to our capital muck raker in chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And today we got a little bit of a kind of, we're switching things up a little bit for week two. If you recall, Sean is out in California on vacation. Last week we talked with Karen Faradin from Berks Gas Truth, and this week we've got a special show planned for you. But Sean Kitchen does make his West Coast debut. He does. So on today's show, I'm going to be actually talking with Dave Levitin about his new book, Not a Scientist, How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. And Dave will also be at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg on Saturday, August 26th at 4 p.m. to discuss and sign copies of his new book. We had a great conversation, recorded it just about an hour and a half ago. And it's a really, really excellent book, basically going through and documenting the kind of rhetorical strategies that politicians use to kind of, you know, obfuscate science, misdirect people, you know, ruin our future. You know how it works. But Sean, as I said, Sean will make his West Coast debut on Out to Coop. We had an opportunity to check in today, and it just happened to work out. So Sean and I talk a little about, we have a short segment. We're talking a little about Charlottesville, California, and, of course, beer. So special Out to Coop today. I want to remind everybody, tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. at 7 p.m. Eastern, folks. I'll be there giving the weekly resistance report once again. And Rick and I basically talk Charlottesville. I mean, I was weighing heavily on our minds, so do check that out. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org, or you can tune in on the Dish Network, DirecTV, and with the Free Speech app on Roku. If you missed the show, no worries. Go to the Free Speech, go to ricksmithshow.com and click on the Free Speech TV icon on the sidebar. But right now, folks, we need you to help pull no punches progressive media. You got to help Raging Chicken Press keep us going strong. You know what I'm saying? Become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to ragingchickenpress.org and look for the support and membership tab. Click become a member and you're on your way. Now, ready to become a member? No problem. You can make a one-time donation by clicking donate. Just we need you folks, the progressive community, to help us deepen Pull No Punches progressive media that will hold power accountable now more than ever. So anyways, I will be back just in a few minutes, and we're going to be talking with Dave Levitin about his new book, Not a Scientist. And then we check in with Sean in the last call today from out in California. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be right back with Dave Levitin.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1985. That was the day that workers at the Hormel plant in Austin, Minnesota, went out on strike. They were members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local P9. Hormel had slashed workers' wages by 23% during the early 1980s. Benefits were also diminished and incentive programs rolled back. These changes cut deeply into the Hormel workers' earnings. What had been considered a good job was changing drastically. This was the story for many workers in Reagan-era America. The 3,500 Hormel workers voted overwhelmingly to strike. The National UFCW discouraged the action. The strike lasted more than a year. Strikebreakers were brought in, including some of the union members who crossed the picket line to return to work. The National Guard was called in to keep the peace between strikers and the scabs. After a year, the strike went down in defeat. Even after the strike, many of the workers were not called back to work. They were put on waiting lists for a job to reopen. Some never returned to the plant. 25 years after the strike, the Austin Daily Herald staff wrote, quote, "What resulted was a bitter, drawn-out labor dispute that drastically impacted the community, from workers who lost their jobs to families that were torn apart by the picket lines. The strike became the feature of a documentary by Barbara Koppel. In 1990, the documentary American Dream won the Academy Award. The film tells the story of the Hormel strike as a window into the tragic experiences of many workers during the 1980s. The film was made on a shoestring budget. Singer Bruce Springsteen provided $25,000 to help support this important film."
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. This is, as I was saying in the intro today, week two without Sean Kitchen. Sean is out gallivanting on the left coast, partaking in national parks and his share of craft beer, we must say. We're actually going to get that update from Sean in the last segment of today's show. So this week, I'm bringing you week two of our special interview Out to Coops. Last week, of course, we had Karen Faradin on from Burke's Gas Truth. And this week, I'm able to welcome Dave Levitin. And he is a greater Philadelphia-based science journalist, and he focuses on an array of scientific topics, especially in ways that science intersects with questions of policy and politics, right up our alley. Dave has written for Scientific American, Yale Environment 360, Slate, On Earth, Conservation, and numerous other publications. Most recently, he's written an awesome book called Not a Scientist: How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. And it was just published this past April, came out from W.W. Norton. And David is going to be visiting the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg on Saturday, August 26th at 4 p.m. to discuss and sign copies of his new book. We're going to have information of that in the show notes for sure, direct link. The Midtown Scholar Bookstore is located at 1302 North 3rd Street in Harrisburg. You can also get more info on the event and the bookstore at www.midtownscholar.com. Special thanks to Alex Brubaker, the Books and Program Manager at Midtown Scholar, for reaching out to us about this event and Dave's new book. So welcome to Out the Coop, Dave.
Thanks very much for having me.
Man, I'm so psyched that this book is coming out, and it's coming out when it is. I mean, you know, partially this is, my own personal interest. You know, I teach rhetoric. I teach analysis of argument and do research, all this other kinds of stuff. And the school year is about to begin. And this is definitely the kind of book I could see actually using in my classes, where you're actually walking us through not simply like the fact that politicians obfuscate things or politicians lie or there's hypocrisy in what they say, but actually breaking down the kind of techniques and, you know, the strategies they use, the rhetorical strategies, I would say, to actually mislead people toward, you know, in for one reason or another.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm glad it's of interest. I definitely just thought it would be a useful thing to sort of show people how politicians tend to take science and twist it to their ideological or policy ends, for sure.
Yeah, one of the things that I really like that you say at the beginning of this book, too, is you say that, look, you know, the whole idea about whether a politician intends to actually manipulate things in this way or that way, if the politician knows in their head what's true and they're purposely lying about it, in a sense, that's an irrelevant question, right? Because we can test that from outside, you know, of the question of intent. So it's not so much about, is this a good or bad person, but it's looking at the consequences of telling particular or engage in particular kinds of obfuscation or distraction.
Yeah, no, I specifically tried to avoid the discussion of intent as much as I could, just because, as you say, it's hard for us to know, you know, for sure what someone is actually intending to do, or whether or not they actually really understand the thing that they're trying to mislead us on. There are certainly times when a politician might, you know, honestly misunderstand an issue. Science is hard, so that could happen, and I didn't want to, you know, go out of my way to claim that they're purposefully lying necessarily. Some of the things I talk about in the book, it is pretty hard to do without meaning to.
Right.
So there are times when I mention, you know, that there are exceptions to this. But I, for the most part, yeah, I leave it up to leave it up to others to maybe try and tease out the intent.
Well, and I like the fact that reason why I like putting a kind of moving intent off the table, not saying that it's not important or it's not relevant or anything like this, but moving that off the table is to say, like, look, the end of the game here is not simply to point out hypocrisy or point out a lie. It's be able to recognize it so that we can do something about it, right? Because there's things at stake. I mean, you know, two of the examples that you use throughout the book, which we're going to get into in a minute, you know, things like, you know, vaccinations, right, and climate change, these have real consequences for real people. So, you know, the science is important. Getting it right is important. And then we have ways of testing that through peer-reviewed journals and kind of the best scientific minds, all that other kind of stuff. So we can point these things out and try to direct policy back in directions that are, you know, are going to be most beneficial for the most amount of people.
Yeah, totally. I think that, you know, if any policy you know, or policy initiatives or legislation that relates to scientific issues, in a way, it almost makes it easier because you can ignore the people, the intent of the person behind it, because, as you say, we have evidence on these things. You can turn straight to evidence and say, you know, this is a good idea or this is a bad idea. Here's why. And I think that it's, you know, if people get used to doing that, to requiring evidence, regardless of the person behind it, then we'd all be a lot better off.
Yeah, I like this a lot. And I think, you know, I also appreciate the book in the sense that, you know, you're going through all these different rhetorical moves and you're not looking for, say, here's the one singular reason why this happens or how this happens, right? It's not just like, you know, the internet has caused a downfall of things, or it's not just fake news. Of course, all those things are relevant here to the discussion. But by the focus on how this specifically happens, I think it's really good. So why don't we get into the book a little bit? And I thought that, well, actually, before we get right into the books, I do want you to kind of walk us through some of these examples because I think they're so useful. But we talked a little bit about this before we went to recording today, and I thought it was interesting to say, you know, kind of what got you to this place to begin with? Like, why, how did you end up kind of, you know, Dave the guy before this book, right? Getting to the point where you say, hey, you know what? Having a book that's kind of walking through these examples, these, you know, rhetorical examples, these strategies regarding science and politics and policy, what kind of put you onto this?
So, the idea came from when I was actually a staff writer for factcheck.org. This was in 2015. I was hired by them as their first ever science writer to cover, you know, politicians getting science wrong. They had covered some of it before, but they got a grant specifically to start a section, which they called SciCheck, just about science and politics. So they hired me to do that. And very quickly in that job, I started to notice patterns, basically, to see very similar types of misdirection or types of error, just techniques for how these politicians tend to get science wrong. So I just started collecting them. And it really didn't take very long before I sort of had a list, which, you know, really does resemble the table of contents that ended up in this book. It just sort of struck me that it would be a useful thing to collect those in one sort of place and explain how they work and how we can spot them and how to, you know, fight through them, I guess, push back a little bit against them. So that was the origin of the idea.
Excellent. And I love the setup of kind of saying here, okay, let's name this thing. Like, here's this one particular move. Let's name it. Here, let's provide a few examples of this and then kind of how it actually functions to obfuscate things. I think that's kind of what I kept on seeing is kind of almost like the methodology chapter by chapter, which makes it that much more user friendly. So let's go right to the beginning of the book. I mean, I love the way that you set the context here is you start with this story about Ronald Reagan. You know, it's during the presidential election against Jimmy Carter in 1980. It's getting towards the end of the campaign. And at the time, there's this big debate about acid rain and so on. And it happened. This kind of touched me right from the beginning. I just got back from the Adirondacks. I was up there for a week. I grew up that way. And I remember growing up, you know, and seeing the tops of the trees gone, right? Precisely because the acid rain would come down and would burn all the new growth on the trees. And we were just up there. And guess what? That new growth is there now, right? So you can actually see these tangible results, you know, so the direct result of policy. Anyways, so this was kind of the issue, right? Because it directly had to do with regulation on industry, right? Particularly industry in the Midwest, heavy industries. So this is kind of how Ronald Reagan responds to Jimmy Carter in that kind of in this debate, right? He says, quote, I have flown twice over Mount St. Helens out on our West Coast. I am not a scientist, and I don't know the figures, but I have a suspicion that that one little mountain out there has probably released more sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere of the world than has been released in the last 10 years of automobile driving or things of that kind that people are so concerned about. Right? And there you go. I'm not a scientist, but the title of your book. So why set us up there?
Yeah, so that was, when I came across that example, I was pretty fascinated. I think a lot of people are probably familiar with the with that talking point, the I'm not a scientist, in a more recent context. A lot of politicians have used it in the last decade, say, most often to do with climate change. And you know, they'll say, I'm not a scientist, so I don't know, you know, exactly what's happening to the climate. But then they'll say that we shouldn't do anything about it.
And they'll say, I have a snowball, right?
Right. But yeah, so I tried to find sort of the origin of that talking point, and that the Reagan example was the first one I could find. I should say, because I'm all about requiring evidence, mm-hmm. I cannot promise that that is the very first time it was used in that way, but it is the first one that I could find. So in my head, at least, it's sort of a founding example of this very, very silly, kind of dumb talking point where a politician will sort of disavow expertise by saying, I'm not a scientist. Then, of course, they go right ahead and say something about science anyway, and not only say something, but then do something about it. They will go ahead and legislate, or in the case of the president, they will, you know, push back against regulations or against legislation in order to push an ideological agenda or policy agenda that really has no basis in the science. In Reagan's case, his point about Mount St. Helens was dramatically wrong. I mean, he was off by many orders of magnitude in mm-hmm. terms of how much sulfur dioxide, which, as you said, that's the primary component of acid rain. Mount St. Helens was not even close to emitting as much sulfur dioxide as humans do, or did at the time, still do. I mean, it wasn't even remotely close. But by saying I'm not a scientist, before saying this, you can kind of, it's an excuse, it's a bit of a smokescreen to sort of get out of actually having to listen to experts.
Well, and it's also, you know, the kind of stuff, I thought it was an interesting marker too as well. Like, again, I know this is not, you're not explicitly making this a like partisan arguments here or things like this, but it does follow, right? This is a marking point, right? Since Ronald Reagan is such a significant marker in kind of the trajectory of Republican politics, right? And the ways the way that the party has moved. And frankly, you know, beginning in like in the 1970s, right around 1970s and with the lead up to Reagan is when you started having the huge investments, you know, by these kind of, you know, right-wing billionaires that really have invested in the anti-science agenda. They really kind of started building their think tanks. They started building their infrastructure around supporting this anti-science agenda. Of course, we also know in 1974, I think, you know, the whole Exxon news stuff, when their climate scientists at Exxon had come out and basically said, no, yep, burning carbon dioxide is warming the earth, and this is a real problem that science have. And then Exxon made a choice right before the 1980 election, right, to say that we're gonna not release our science, right? We're not gonna support their science. Instead, we're gonna invest in anti-climate change denialism, right? Back in then. So there's these things that are coming together at this point, which give us that kind of historical context for Reagan. And what's interesting too as well, of course, Reagan is known as the great storyteller, right? And that story about him flying over Mount St. Helens has all the components of a really compelling story, right? It shifts everything away from that question of the evidence, right, into this kind of effect, right? Like this silly stuff. Look at this giant exploding volcano that everyone was just concerned with on the news. You can see the smoke and the ash coming out of this stuff where you don't even see this in cars, you know, a few stuff like this. So it has this way of drawing everything back to experience, back to, you know, what we all know, as opposed to having us and then basically turning away from those silly experts. And I thought that story contained like several of the different things that you touch upon all throughout this book.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a useful sort of, I mean, parable might be the wrong word, but it's a, as a founding example, it's a good one, really. Yeah, and he, I think you're right about how the sort of this conversion of forces, I guess, at around that period of time when science started to become more of a political issue, and I think that's definitely true. I mean, if you look more into say the 50s, scientists in general were just much more sort of deified, and I mean, maybe that's not necessarily a good thing, but it was a lot less controversial to make a scientific claim based on expertise, right? And by right. the '80s, you know, you could pick and choose which scientific claims you felt like, you know, confirming is true, regardless of what the actual science said. But yeah, so it's a good sort of marker, I guess, as you said.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Is that, you know, one of the things that, you know, the whole science question comes up is like, you know, we can't, you know, there's nothing wrong with being skeptical of some scientific stuff, right? Or talking about just because we have conclusion X, right, doesn't mean that something automatically good follows, right? I mean, Oppenheimer was famous as saying, you know, basically when he got the atomic bomb to work, is basically, you know, those words were, it works, right? And I think we could say, like, yes, you know, some positive things came out, some really negative things came out of that. So we still have all sorts of ethical questions and political questions and policy questions around this. It doesn't negate those things, but it basically establishes us a playing field that we're all saying that, hey, we're willing to play on the ground of the facts, not just on the ground of belief. So I think those are important distinctions too as well. So it's not just like science is great and we just listen to them no matter what. No, we have other values and ethics and things like this that we want to kind of sort out to as well. So it comes back to the political realm. But we can't even get to that point if we're going to kind of, like, you know, throw facts to the wind and do whatever we're going to do and treat science as if it's just another story that we tell.
Yeah, no, you make an interesting point. And it reminds me, I got to interview John Holdren, who was President Obama's science advisor. He said something that I found really interesting about how, basically about trying to convince, you know, the president from his position on a certain topic or whatever, any scientific issue. He said that you want to make sure that scientific input is there when there's an issue that matters and that someone is listening to that scientific input, but you shouldn't pretend that it is going to be the only input. That there are, as you said, there are other factors involved with major policy decisions or political decisions that we shouldn't ignore. I mean, science is, you know, something that is a very useful framework for understanding the world, but you can't just, you know, just saying this is a fact and therefore nothing else matters is actually not that useful. It all has to go in, you know, that all these inputs have to come together in a way that we all agree is useful. But the starting point for that is that we all have to agree that you know, there are certain sets of facts that are true or that are at least our best understanding of something. If we can't even agree on that, as you said, you know, we're kind of screwed before we start.
Exactly. And I like what you just said there, too, as well. It's like, the, you know, again, that we're true or at least the best that we can understand something. You know, I always say this is one of the things that I'll talk about in my classes, for example, the difference between what I would say philosophy and rhetoric. Right. There's philosophy that you want that capital T truth. Right. Get to that thing, which is the ultimate right thing that's out there. Right. To know the thing as it is, all that other stuff. In rhetoric, you're saying, like, OK, you also want to know about truth, but you also have, you're under an obligation to act. Right. So that you're always going to be in a situation where it's not about getting the perfect answer to absolutely everything before you act. It's by saying you want to know as best you possibly can at any given moment so that you're informed to make the best decision possible. And even then, it's not automatically clear what that solution is. But that's a little aside from the point. But I mean, it's the same kind of stuff. We got to get to the point where we got to be able to break through how people are trying to drive us away from this. So in this book, you give us these 12 rhetorical moves, I would call them, these 12 moves, these scientific moves, and the oversimplification, the cherry pick, the butter up and undercut, the demonizer, the blame the blogger, the ridicule and dismiss, the literal nitpick, the credit snatch, which I thought that was actually a cool one, actually. That was a neat move there. The certain uncertainty, the blind eye to follow up, the lost in translation, and the straight up fabrication. And again, great names to be able to pick out and to pull them away. So out of these, do you have any particular favorites or ones that you find that are particularly telling or useful right now?
Yeah. So why don't we, since you actually sort of described one of them just a minute ago, why don't we start with the certain uncertainty?
Mm-hmm.
That one, I mean, you were sort of saying just a minute ago about how, you know, you need to use the, just because we don't know everything doesn't mean we shouldn't act on something. And that's exactly what that technique is. A lot of times you'll hear politicians say, you know, we don't have all the facts yet, or, I mean, this is very commonly used about climate change, you know.
Yep.
It's hard to predict exactly. We don't know how much the world is warming, or we don't know how much the seas will rise, or anything like that. And they use that argument as a way to say, because we don't have definitive, specific answers, we should do nothing. So it's a, and the reason it's so insidious is because it actually sometimes sounds reasonable. I mean, the message is essentially, look before you leap.
Right.
Understand what you're doing before you do something about it, which, you know, on its face is not an unreasonable thing to say. But the problem is that when it comes to science, there is always uncertainty. Every measurement ever taken on anything has a margin of error. You know, it has a plus or minus that you can't ever get around. Now, that does not mean we don't know anything. It doesn't mean we don't know extremely well that the climate is changing, that it is, you know, how much it has warmed. We have pretty good ideas of how much it will warm. We have pretty solid ideas, at least in a longer term, over how much the seas will rise, although we don't know exactly how long it will take to do so. You know, these things are sure, there are always going to be uncertainties, but they really harp on this as a way to stop us from doing anything, again, because it sounds reasonable to make that argument. But, you know, it is incredibly unreasonable once you actually think about it.
No, absolutely. And I like, for exactly this reason, the way you begin this chapter, right, you take us out of the climate change debate or the kind of big scientific debate. You say, okay, let's imagine ourselves in this doctor's office, right? Let's imagine you're going to a doctor, right? The doctor says, you know, guess what? You've got lung cancer. Right. And said, well, don't worry, because usually the prognosis for this is actually pretty good. It's fairly treatable and things like this. And so you as a patient say, phew, thank God this has been bothering me, whatever like that. So what do we do the treatment? And then the doctor says, oh, no, no, we're not going to treat you because we don't know exactly why you got this particular kind of cancer. Right. So therefore, until we know exactly where it came from and why you specifically have this particular kind of cancer, we can't treat it, even though the prognosis would be great if we did. Right. I mean, I thought that was kind of a useful move too, as well, and to say, well, OK, let's think about this in practical terms, because just like you said, very many of these moves have an inkling of, you know, good advice that you would give people, you know, look before you leap. But when you start putting in other contexts with other very, you know, similar but personal examples, people might be able to get to see that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's tough to get through for people who maybe just haven't, you know, I also want to stress that, you know, people who don't happen to know a lot about these particular scientific topics, it's totally defensible to, you know, to think that these arguments might be reasonable. We can't all be experts on everything. So, you know, the point is to just learn to hear where people are trying to mislead you a little bit. And also at the beginning of that chapter, I have a quote from someone named Stefan Lewandowski, who I always found, which I always find really interesting. He says, and I don't have it directly in front of me, but it's basically, not doing something about climate change is equivalent to not wearing a seatbelt or something like that when you're driving 80 miles an hour into a brick wall, because you might not die. Just like, you know, so do you feel lucky? Yeah, sure. Maybe you won't die, but it seems very bizarre to not take action on the very good chance that something bad is going to happen. So climate is a great example for this, because, you know, sort of a precautionary principle kind of idea. There is such a good chance that bad things are going to happen. And it will be, you know, it's actually cheaper for the world. I mean, this is a separate issue, but it's cheaper for the world to address it than not address it. So why wouldn't we? You know, why wouldn't you take even if you think that we don't know exactly what's going to happen, why wouldn't you, you know, protect yourselves against the worst possible outcomes?
Right. Especially because, you know, when you're talking about the cost of taking action, right, say, for example, investing in renewable resources and things like this, doesn't have a whole lot of negative ends of it, except for major interests like fossil fuel industries and things like this. Obviously, it's going to talk about major transformation and that kind of stuff. But the idea that, okay, look, actually investing in kind of new sectors of an economy might not be, you know, over the long term good. Because guess what? Even if we double down on extractivism right now, well, we're eventually going to run out of this stuff, right? So why not get ahead of the game, right? I mean, even in that as a precautionary tale, I think is really useful. You know, one of the things that I think that makes some of this stuff so insidious, and while this inaction one is what bothers me to no end, is that when, like, if you start looking at what people are actually doing, right? What people in power are actually doing, and to basically make sure that they're safe when climate change happens, right? When if there's any kind of catastrophic effects of climate change that are kind of on the horizon, they're already prepping for them. So that's everything from kind of like making sure they're securing, basically sea rights to be able to kind of go across the Arctic Circle, or if it means out west, right, claiming property rights over kind of empty aquifers and then building abandoned luxury towns that are walled off so that they can fill the aquifer with, right, and so that those people will have water because they can afford it while other people will not. You know, these are people that are investing millions and millions and millions of dollars, right, prospecting on that future of catastrophic climate change. So, you know, people are already making those moves. And so, you know, from a political perspective, when I see these things, and I know a lot of folks that are listening to this program, Read, Rage, and Chicken, and so off, will kind of recognize this, is that what a lot of these moves seem to be designed to do is keep most of us guessing. Right, is to keep most of the population who are not experts, right, who don't, you know, look, frankly, most of us don't have time to get involved and deep in the science and that kind of stuff and do all the reading that, you know, quote unquote, we should do. And so we want to keep us guessing to the point where we're not making rash decisions. But really, the agenda is basically to say we want to keep you from deciding. And I go all the way back, you know, this was, you know, there's a long history of this in American politics and even American journalism, for that matter. Right. Walter Lippmann, I mean, talked about this. Say, you don't really need the engaged citizens. Right. What you need is just you need to be able to kind of convince people to decide to choose X or choose Y. Right. And that's really the game is. Right. You don't need to know why they're choosing X or Y. You just need them to do X or Y, and that's the game of politics. I'm being very reductive here, obviously. But and that's a similar kind of thing here. On the one hand, you got these folks that are making moves to protect themselves and their interest. On the other hand, they're telling everybody else, like, we have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, the example a lot of people have brought up recently is the I think it was Trump has a golf course in Scotland where they wanted to
windmills.
I forget exactly, but they had one of the protect against sea level rise because it was on the coast of Scotland, or maybe Ireland, I forget.
But Scotland, yep.
And you know, so they're basically acknowledging that sea level rise is happening and it's a big deal, and they're trying to build a seawall or something like that. They need permits for it. And meanwhile, of course, Trump pulls out of the Paris Agreement and spends all his time talking about how climate change is a hoax. So yeah, it's not exactly a consistent position for a lot of these people.
That's for sure. So if you pull another one out for us, what are some other ones you want to draw our attention to?
Sure. Another one that I find sort of, it's probably the one that gets me the most angry, I guess, is the ridicule and dismiss. Mm-hmm. So the idea here is that politicians will often describe some bit of science or a certain study or a certain issue in just ridiculous terms, very sort of silly sounding, dumb sounding terms as a way to dismiss the possibility that we should be doing this. A lot of people have probably heard of something called the Waste Book, which was Senator Tom Coburn would put this out. And yeah, there have been other versions of this that other politicians have done too, with similar names to Waste Book. Basically, they catalog government funding that they find to be ridiculous as a way to try and, you know, show that we should cut funding for pretty much everything. These things aren't always about science, but science often is in there because scientific studies, especially basic research, often does sound ridiculous if you describe it in a certain way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the examples I have in there is about a particular bit of research on fruit flies and how, you know, if you say it a certain way, it sounds silly. It's something like, they spent $1 million to study whether male fruit flies prefer younger female fruit flies, mm-hmm. which, yeah, that sounds dumb. Why would anybody spend $1 million to do that? However, when you actually describe the research in question, you know, as it really should be described, it sounds a lot better. Basically, they're doing research into how sexual reward promotes healthy aging and how aging is related to sex and everything in fruit flies. Yes, because that's what we do with science. We study fruit flies and mice and rats and zebrafish and all sorts of other things as a way to understand people. That's just how science works.
Right.
But they use this all the time, and it's so maddening because it's used as a way to try and cut funding for the National Institutes of Health, for National Science Foundation, for the primary means of supporting basic scientific research in this country. And without that basic science funding, I mean, we don't have a lot of things. I mean, without NIH, we don't have the extra 30 years of lifespan that we have over 1900. You know, I mean, these things, it's just an incredible bit of misdirection. And frankly, it's one that it's weird that it's still used, because funding for NIH has actually become sort of a bipartisan agreement. Like, a lot of Republicans do actually agree this is a good use of money, because it ends up saving the country so much money on healthcare in the future. I mean, there's sort of, you know, differing estimates of returns on investment and everything. But generally speaking, spending money on basic research is a great idea. So ridiculing it is really sort of insidious, I think.
Well, I think, you know, again, this is a little bit outside of the scope of your book, but I think that one of the consequences of a lot of these moves has also to do with the target of a particular, say, class of, say, intellectual, right? You're talking about as experts and so on, and wanting to basically discipline these folks to be able to kind of fall in line around political ends. And what I mean by that is something along this lines, right? If I can ridicule the science, and if, like, and you find this as you go further and further to the margins, right? So say, for example, it's one thing for a politician to get up and kind of belittle this, as the examples that you give in your book, like fruit flies, it sounds ridiculous, right? Really, this is what they're doing? But then you start moving into right-wing radio, and the way that that conversation is translated is like, yeah, you got a bunch of sex-starved scientists that are out there. They got nothing better to do with their time to whether to see if this fruit fly can get some, because they're not getting any, right? I mean, and that's the way that conversation actually gets translated, right? And so then what you have now is you've created an audience, right, that has now you created a particular picture of these scientists, right, as the ones that they're the geeks who can't get any, right, who are out there and doing, you know, spending these people's hard-earned dollars, right, to get off their kind of, you know, sex joys or whatever it is like that in the lab. And that basically undercuts any kind of legitimacy of this person as the scientist is doing legitimate work. It reduces them to this kind of, like, you know, this high school characterization of the guy, you know, the lab guy in the corner, the geek in the corner, whatever like this, that everyone else can laugh at. I mean, it, as bad as it sounds, I mean, that is the extension of, you know, this kind of reality TV show and all sorts of stuff that has been, that's made up for that. So even when you were able to parse some of this stuff in the public sphere, right, and what we're seeing on, say, news and that kind of stuff, the way that that gets mobilized, right, politically mobilized, can be really dangerous, because then you've got a chunk of people, and we're seeing this right now, and like with the Trump supporters, the hardcore Trump supporters, no matter what this guy does, right, and this has been remained relatively consistent, no matter what this guy does, no matter what he says, you still got 25-30% of the people that are dead fast supporters, right, and that's because that they've got that echo chamber that is kind of coming back and forth, that's reinforcing it, and has everything to do with affect, mobilizing particular kinds of feelings about people than it is with kind of what the facts as a whole. So, I mean, again, I see so many of these things. I'm saying, you know, on the one hand, you know, there's particular depictions of scientists. And this is what I like the discussion around NASA and things, because NASA is always, you know, that aspirational scientific, you know, government agency, at least for the most part, right? Until it's not, right? Until actually, as you lay out the stuff about, until NASA, you know, you realize, well, NASA actually contributes a lot to climate science. So that we need to find a way to undercut that, yet without now taking away about the fantasy about space. So interesting stuff that's going on. So let me ask you, this is one of the things that, and I've had this conversation with so many people, I can't even tell you, when you're talking about the anti-vaxxers and the anti-vaxxers and the autism connection, for example, right? You mentioned this at one point. I was so happy to hear you saying this, is that you talk about the herd protection, right? You talk about, you know, the fact that the reason why you want high levels of vaccination is because there are some people that are at risk, right? But as long as the vaccination levels are high enough, right, then these other people won't be at risk, right? Because that's just part of it. And I happen to be in this very, very small minority of people. My family has an allergy to a component of the MMR vaccination, right? So for example, like real documented medical, right, allergy to the MMR, not autism. My sister is mentally handicapped because, number one, because of the MMR and because of medical malpractice at the hospital that they went to, they didn't give her the right night, stuff to bring down the swelling in her brain, basically. So she got encephalitis and so on, and she's brain damaged as a result. I was in a coma when I got it, right? So things like this. So we have two young kids, and we're very cautious with our children, right, about this. So I've talked to my dad and my stepmom, who they had kids and how they dealt with it with them. And basically, they waited a little bit until their immunity system had built up. This is based upon medical advice that we have been given, right? So that had been the context that I had grown up with, right? I had to get doctor's notes, letting people know about this and so on. Now, when we had our kids, right, because of this anti-vaxxer stuff, it was virtually impossible to actually get a doctor to listen to us about that history, because you watch that happen. The doctors would start rolling their eyes, and they put us in this category of these anti-vaxxers, right? And so we have to bring in like reams and reams of documentation just to get them to see that we weren't part of the crazies. And that worries me, because basically what it's saying is that by the fact that they've gotten so many inroads on this kind of anti-vaxxing stuff, is it's actually putting people at risk, right? Not just themselves, but putting people at risk, and even kind of dividing the debate in ways that are not fruitful, right? Because science, as you say in the book over and over again, science is hard, number one, and it's complicated, right? It's not black and white, either or, yes or no, right? There's a range of possibilities here. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, that the anti-vaxxer stuff not only, you know, just sort of directly harms people in the sense that now they might get measles,
right.
you know, just a direct consequence of this. But yeah, it can have these other effects where the discussion around it has changed to the point where, where doctors might be a little less receptive to something like your situation, where there is a medical reason where someone can't get a vaccination or you know, has to wait or whatever the situation may be. Clearly, there are times when that is true. But yeah, by hijacking the conversation into this realm that has just literally no scientific basis whatsoever, you know, it's all based on one tiny paper of 15 kids that was retracted and guy lost his medical license for it because it was complete fraud. That's the entire basis of that. So yeah, it's a sort of secondary effect that now people might not listen to the actual medical needs involved here. It's really unfortunate. But I mean, I think the way to fight back against that, I guess, is to try and, you know, sort of inundate the conversation with the idea that, you know, this connection with autism is completely fraudulent, that there is no connection whatsoever. So if that becomes just sort of the standard discussion, which in you know, this is still a relatively small fringe group of people who disagree with that.
Right.
But still, if you can, the whole point here is to make it nearly impossible for anyone to make that claim. And so when politicians make it, you know, people with large platforms, with large audiences, you know, they can do an incredible amount of damage to the public health in one sentence. And even if they take it back, I mean, you know, I wrote a few years ago about Rand Paul from Kentucky, who made a comment about vaccines that he then took back like a day later, and he even appeared in the New York Times getting a booster vaccine for hepatitis A or something. It doesn't matter at that
right.
point. You know, you're adding legitimacy just by saying it the first time. So that's an example where we the public need to be incredibly vocal about, you know, pushing back against it, because it is so potentially damaging to public health.
That's a great point. So, Dave Levitan is going to be visiting the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg on Saturday, August 26th at 4 p.m. to discuss this book, Not a Scientist, How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. We're also going to put a link down in the show notes here to his book, and we hope you're going to pick it up. And if you pay close attention, that we may have some special kind of extra copies for some people listening to the show today that we'll give up, and we'll have some more details about that coming up too as well. So, Dave, you know, in the end, you got this book, you know, you're kind of making your rounds on here. If you kind of give us a snapshot of kind of where you see things now, right, and what you hope to kind of come out of this. I mean, obviously, no one book is going to kind of transform everything that's out there. I mean, but I think this is really a significant contribution. So how do you see things moving, right, or what do you hope to see kind of coming out of this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I can't say I'm super optimistic about the way things are right now in terms of the rhetoric around science and politics and everything. I am encouraged, I guess, by just sort of the growth in interest in fact checking and sort of discussion of the need to focus on fact and truth. I mean, clearly the reason that discussion is happening is because of some people are ignoring those facts, but at least the discussion is happening. So there's some sort of bright spot there. I think in terms of science in general, if I had to pick, we're moving in the right direction, but it's not like a definitively right direction. It's like just sort of veering a little bit in the right direction. There's still so much, effort by politicians put into confusing us and misleading us on these issues. And I mean, I'm not so naive to think that that's going to go away ever, as long as there's, a special interest group out there that has some reason to get science wrong, then the politicians that they support are also going to get science wrong. But I guess I'm seeing some very sort of mildly encouraging signs that people are starting to push back a little bit. And hopefully, the book is some mild, tiny bit of ammunition in that fight.
Well, I would say it is. I mean, I would say definitively it is on my end, at least, because it does things that I think are so important for social movements. The way I look at it, and for people, and for an educated citizenry, is the things that, like I said before, you've named these things, right? And I think that's part of the deal, right? Being able to say we're going to be able to call this the cherry pick, we're going to be able to call this the butter up and undercut, we're going to be able to call this the blame the blogger, and so that helps in recognizing when those moves are being made. That's really good. The other thing that I'm really encouraged by, is basically look back to what we saw the March for Science, right? When scientists themselves are getting to that point, right? Carnegie Mellon's done some great work on this in scientific communication, right? Basically saying, listen, scientists, you got to get out of the lab and you got to be able to communicate this to a broader public. That's something I think that we've lost for a while, that I think that, both political parties, for that matter, with their over-reliance upon experts, have forgotten that part of what you need to do then is that you need to move from, okay, yes, we need to get the research, but then we need to be able to communicate it to a broader public, right? And again, I think this is a great place, spot where your book fits into that. It helps bridge that gap so that we're not just saying requiring of everybody to go out and learn all the science so that you can be a physicist too, but you're understanding the communication around science and why these things are important. So, man, I really appreciate you taking time for us, and congratulations on this awesome book.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate that. And thanks for having me on. That was fun.
All right, everybody, remember the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg, Saturday, August 26th. Dave will be there at 4 p.m. to discuss his new book, Not a Scientist, How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. This has been awesome. I'm so psyched that Dave could join us today. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will be back right after this.
Was a massacre in church that got certain forces moving. Many towns are now at least superficially improving, such as in Virginia, where a statue of General Lee stands as a reminder of the days of slavery. In the city center, an indelible mark in the spot that's been renamed Emancipation Park, slated for removal when a judge intervened, which might be the moment that most fully set the scene for 19 injured, one killed today in Charlottesville. With their men in the White House, members of the right marched through the university, torches alight, chanting against immigrants, Africans, and Jews. But it's not the flying bottles that put them in the news, so much as the bigot in the car, revving his engine loud, speeding forward and then back, running down the crowd, using the same tactic promoted by Islamic State. Maybe he was even shouting, God is great. 19 injured, one killed today in Charlottesville. More than half the city used to be in chains, now their descendants, who still remain, are being forced to leave by gentrification, just like poor white folks all across the nation. And with the presidential tweets and xenophobic rants, it's just a matter of time before some pawn takes the chance to plow into a march with half a ton of steel. This is not fake news, it's real. 19 injured, 1 killed today in Charlottesville.
This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, coming to you with Sean Kitchen, special from the left coast. Sean, man, how is it out in Cali?
Oh, it is awesome out here. It's like 80, every day it's been 80 degrees and like 0% humidity. You know, even like we went to the desert a few days ago, Joshua Tree National Park, which is absolutely phenomenal. Hit up a bunch of national parks, but Joshua Tree, it was like 85 and sunny out the whole time. And, you know, it's great desert weather.
Yeah, great desert weather. Well, you know something? When I was out there with my, you know, my family earlier on this year, I was like, man, the weather is so awesome. I actually got to the point, though, where I was like, okay, I need some clouds, man. I feel like I'm being, like, stared on by some sort of surveillance camera all the time.
Yeah. No, so I actually have a couple good stories. Yosemite National Park was freaking phenomenal.
Yeah, your pictures from Yosemite were amazing.
Yeah, it was probably one of my favorite parks next to the Grand Canyon. Like, in my like, we've been to a bunch of national parks on our vacation, and like the Grand Canyon is absolutely the best, one of the best parks you can do. Like, we hiked down to the bottom, slept overnight on the bottom of the canyon, hiked back up the next day. This is about like 8 years, 6 or 7 years ago, but when I would put Yosemite like in that like pantheon of national parks that we have out here. The first day, hiked up to the upper Yosemite Falls, which was freaking awesome. It was like 3.5 miles. It took me like 2.5 hours doing this 3 mile hike, just going straight uphill switchbacks. But the views of like Half Dome from up there, a couple of the vistas that were up there, was absolutely phenomenal. Next day I tried hiking up to the top of Glacier Point, which is like going to be like, was a 10-hour hike. I made it 4 hours in and I turned around just from being worn out the day before. But no, it was awesome.
I saw your post on that. You say, you know what? I made the smart choice and I turned back around and went back down. And so I'm glad you made that choice too, as well. So we weren't kind of like reading about you on the news, like, you know, Philadelphia area, like native lost in Yosemite National Park. We find your mangled bones with the grizzlies later on. Funny, not funny. I know, but
but also, like, so you know, the seriousness of these parks is like real. I mean, like, you know, I don't know if you've been paying attention, but out here it's been on the news a lot. A couple went into Joshua Tree a couple weeks ago, and they got out of their car and must have like lost sight of the road, and they went missing for the past 2 weeks.
Oh man,
you know, they weren't campers or anything like that. So I mean, it's very serious. You got to definitely be safe when you're out here. These parks are no jokes. You know, they're beautiful and everything, but you also have to have that like wherewithal. You know, any slightest mistake, you can get yourself lost and, you know, ultimately killed.
No, that's absolutely true. And we were just in like in Sequoia National Park, and you're driving through there, and just to give them the scope on it, it's the first time I actually had been to like one of the major national parks out west, and just the sheer size of like the wild. Kind of underscored Sequoia, exactly that.
Yeah, we spent night in Sequoia as well, and Sequoia was, you know, Yosemite was where all the tourists went. Sequoia is where like your backcountry campers, fishers, and the hunters would go. That's more of your recreational park in the Sierras, and you know, I was out taking, trying to do some star photos with my camera, and because I have like a camera remote for it. And, you know, like this is like even like 15 feet outside of our hotel, our lodge door. We're in this like lodge, and it's so dark and all. So every, the whole entire sky's lit up, and someone just came up to me. He's like, "Hey, do you see that cat over there?" And I'm like, "What cat?"
You mean like meow cat?
And there's a cat hanging. Yeah, there was a, there was like this like a bobcat or something hanging around the trash cans where I was shooting photos at, and I got some good star shots, like just like messing around with the camera. And I just packed it up and went right back in. You know, I could deal with bears. You know, bears and coyotes are fine because they're generally will like go away from you. Cats, I don't mess with cats.
Yes, sir. Sean Kitchens, wildlife adventure advice. Don't mess with cats.
Cats are like a bit more dangerous and unpredictable than bears and wolf coyotes and stuff like that because they won't like they'll be startled by you, but the cats.
Bobcats aren't bad though. Bobcats you don't have to worry as much about. It's when you start getting into mountain lions and things like this, then you're prey.
Sequoia is known for its mountain lions.
Yeah, exactly. So
any type of cat, I assume it's a mountain lion. I'm just getting.
I get you. Like, hey, better safe than sorry, right? Let me go see if that does it have the little wisps of fur around its muzzle? Should I be okay with? No, how about just go away? It's good. Well, okay, so you know, I definitely want to get in and talk about the beer stuff and things like this. Some of the things we've been doing here, but one of the reasons why that Sean really wanted to check in today is like, you know, he and I have been going back and forth a little bit on this, and I don't know how you know anybody kind of. Can stay away from this stuff. But I mean, what happened in Charlottesville last weekend, I mean, has been weighing on, I mean, all, like our minds like insane. And, you know, we're going to devote, and I mentioned this on our Facebook Live yesterday, but we're going to devote next week's show, not entirely. I mean, obviously there's going to be crazy amounts of stuff that's going on. But we're going to really get in more deeply to what happened in Charlottesville. And, you know, Sean, it's got to be kind of a little, I don't know, it's a whole different experience when you're sitting there, you're out there on vacation, and you have something like this kind of go down.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely a reflection point. I've just been like going ham on Twitter with stuff lately. But like, I mean, one of the things I was tweeting about is like, you know, one of the threads I put out there is like my first protest was, you know, organizing out in Kutztown against the higher education cuts with Corbett. I think got like 50 to 100 students out that day, you know, locally around campus. And, you know, got involved with Occupy, then, like, did a bunch of stuff, you know, with the Raging Chicken right afterwards. And, you know, I never really went to my first anti-fascist protest, you know, right with the Chicken or as a demonstrator until this past year, right? It was just never something that was on my mind. And, you know, like, thinking about that lady who died, Heather Hare.
Yeah.
You know, that, like, first initial thoughts, like, you know, I had friends who were within close vicinity to that, you know, couple writers from Occupy Wall Street, a couple people I know online, journalists and stuff like that, they were on that street mm-hmm. when that car went barreling down the road into those protesters. And, you know, like, it first reaction was that could have been me. Mm-hmm. Like, when I heard that, like, you know what I mean? Just from, like, going, if I went there, shoot, like, that's the type of thing where I would have tried to go down to Charlottesville, document what was going on because of the how big that event was going to be. You know, to get pictures, to get video, to get, like, you know, report back on it, you know, because there's a lot of people from the area who went down to Charlottesville from Harrisburg and from central Pennsylvania, you know, to be part of the counter anti-fascist protest.
No, and this is the kind of stuff, and, you know, I was thinking about that because, you know, these are, like, some of the people from Harrisburg, from the Harrisburg area, from Pennsylvania, that you have covered, right, have been part of some of the actions that you've covered out there in Harrisburg, were down there.
Yeah, and also, like, the people we reported on were there, right? We've been following Vanguard America for the past few months. We've been following Identity Europa and what they've been doing on college campuses in Pennsylvania. We've been following this militia, the Lightfoot militia groups, you know, like these are all people who we ran into at prior demonstrations in Pennsylvania. These people are active out here. And it was, you know, as soon as I saw the guy's picture, you know, with him holding the shield, I knew what group that was he was with right away. Like, you know, and it was just like, wow, like these are the people we saw just a couple months ago in Harrisburg for the March Against Sharia.
Well, you know, it's, you and I had some conversations about this, just, you know, not as part of the podcast and stuff, but, you know, just in a sense, trying to gauge, you know, how we cover some of these things and stuff, because, you know, I'll tell you, it's when you get a lot of people kind of poo-pooing kind of coverage of, you know, say the anti-fascist stuff or about these marches, they really want you to kind of, you know, they'd rather you just not pay attention to those Nazis, not pay attention to those KKK people, not pay attention to those alt-right things, and they'll go away. You know, we've consistently come down on, you know, on the side of no, we need to be covering this stuff and shining a spotlight on these things. And, you know, and part of it, though, is that when you start covering it, you're always trying to gauge, like, okay, how much of this, like, explosion of the alt-right is really an explosion, and how much of it has to do with, you know, the fact that we're covering these that happen to be going on right now. And we keep on coming back, and no, this is growing, and, you know, Trump administration is basically fanning the flames. And to see then all those people that we've been tracking, have been talking about, you know, to see, you know, their monikers, to see their, you know, their symbols, to see them, you know, in on the pages of the New York Times being interviewed, right, at the University of Virginia march, you know, here you go, Vanguard America, here you go, you got what do you call it, Identity Europa, and to know that, yeah, these are the same folks that are right down the road from where we live.
And like, one of the things, you know, what I did right away, as soon as I saw that one guy, you know, Christian Yingling from the Pennsylvania Lightfoot Militia, I was like, holy shit, I know who he is.
Yep.
And really, like, I was looking on Twitter, and there's maybe some tweets about him, like three or four people, like, there's only like a handful, like 10 tweets about this guy here. And I decided, you know, like, hey, let's put this article out. Meet the Pennsylvania militia at the Charlottesville rally. Right. And
yeah. And you practically crashed our website because of that article.
I mean, that's gotten like close to like 45,000 hits within the past few days. Quickly became our most read article, most clicked article. Definitely our most shared article on social media, our most commented article. There's like, what, we got about 150 comments on that like thread right now.
Yep.
Like, of people just going back and forth. You know, look at the discussion that put out there. You know, we didn't get cited for this, but New York Times, Washington Post, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Heavy, Quartz, you know, all these different outlets, national outlets and local outlets are now starting to like pay attention to this guy in particular.
Yeah, it was actually, well, the thing that I was happy about is that if you actually, you look deeper in some, you know, this is getting, whatever, in the weeds for everybody a little bit, but you look at some of the analytics of stuff, you know, because you're looking at the site and kind of, you know, tracking, you know, how many people looking at different articles and that kind of stuff. What had happened in the aftermath of, you know, you posting that one article, there were a whole bunch of people that were going back and checking out other stuff that we have written about, you know, Identity Europa, about
Market, Identity Europa, the Harrisburg March Against Sharia.
Exactly. And I think, you know, again, this is something that, you know, we talked about years ago. It's like, you know, part of the job of, you know, progressive alternative media, kind of like what we're trying to do, is that, yeah, you're covering a kind of anti-fascist, you know, resistance to the alt-right in Harrisburg. Okay, it might not get, you know, this kind of huge, you know, coverage everywhere, but part of what you're doing is you're providing documentation on the line, right, or like on a daily basis of the development of this stuff, so that when something like this does happen, I mean, God forbid this happens again, but now you've got a body of work that people can track some of this stuff. I mean, you know, so at least there was that going on, and people were digging into some of those articles a little bit to realize that, look, we've got a serious problem in Pennsylvania and across the country for that matter.
And also a couple of quick points, I guess. Did you see the coverage Daryl Metcalf's been getting? The Pennsylvania Republican Party is now defending Metcalf, saying it was just an isolated incident about his white nationalists. And, you know, I've been hitting Metcalf hard the past few days, and also the Pennsylvania Republican Party. You know, and I like this analogy, really. You know, I was watching – I think Matto were all in the other night. I think it was Matto when Joy Reid was filling in. And they had a lady on there, African-American scholar, and she put it so aptly that, like, the white nationalist, the white supremacist, the racist, the bigotry has become, like, the drug that the Republicans have kept on going back to, you know, over and over again just to get that hit. Get those votes. And Daryl Metcalf, you know, he is that white supremacist crack pipe.
Yep.
that the Pennsylvania Republican Party has been hitting on and going back to, and they don't like it, but they're addicted to it. And that's he's that white nationalist crack pipe that they've been hitting, or meth pipe, but you know, what's but that they've been hitting to get votes within their base.
No, Sean, it's a great point. I mean, I love that connection. And by the way, anybody out there is listening to us at this point, right? If you have any audio of Daryl Metcalf, his best ofs and best worst ofs, right? You want to kind of hit us up and send us our way. I would love to kind of get some of Metcalf quotes on the audio board for next week's show, because I think that we need to go hard at this guy, because, you know, people are starting to ask the question, like, I can't believe, like, how is it that this guy stays in power? Well, you know, when exactly what you said, when you are the crack that is in the pipe, and the rest of the party is puffing away, man, that's your answer. And there's no other answer. It is the Republican Party in Pennsylvania.
I guess the last quick point I'd like to make, it's amazing how the media narrative of anti-fascism has completely did a reversal over the past week, thanks to Mein Fuhrer Donald Trump coming out and saying alt-left, that there was
the
bad alt-left people on both sides.
Well, yeah, and
basically
it's
saying how, like,
go ahead,
like,
sorry.
Now you have people like Mitt Romney saying, no, there's no moral equivalencies here. You know, one side's Nazis, the other side's opposing them.
Right.
Like,
right.
Like, mainstream Republicans are now being boxed in the corner. Do we go after both sides on this? No, we go after the Nazis because the Nazis are freaking horrible people.
Right. And, you know, the interesting is that Sam Cedar and Majority Report made a really interesting point the other day, is that, you know, got one of, you know, Trump's lead lawyers is his name's Cohen. Right. And he's Jewish. Right. And then what Sam Cedar was saying is, like, you know, what should be happening right now is that you should have groups of rabbis and things like this showing up at this guy's synagogue. Right. Basically saying, are you the guy? Right. Are you the guy when he shows up? Right. When he showed up to the synagogue, are you the guy who's covering for Nazis? Right, because that guy is not going to want to be that guy in his community that is going to be the Nazi sympathizer.
And also, like, one of the people I follow on Facebook, she listens to the podcast a lot, Lee Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
She came up with this. She sent me a good term. Back in World War II, within the concentration camps, there's this term called capo. And they were the Jewish prisoners who were your gang leaders, your thugs, your gangsters, pretty much. And their job were to keep. They were Jewish prisoners. Their job as the capo was to keep the other prisoners in line on behest of the Nazis. And in return, they would get private living quarters.
Oh,
they'd
man.
Get actual food. They would get
collaborators,
civilian clothes and stuff like that. You know, and basically, like, you know, she's starting to make those historical connections between that and people within the Republican Party of Pennsylvania, you know, people within the Republican Party who are covering for Metcalf. You know, they're like, it's, we've had these conversations, and it's just amazing. And it's also the conversations are being had now, especially within the Indivisible groups, on Facebook. And, you know, like a few weeks ago, they're saying, no, we shouldn't endorse this violence. And now people are starting to talk anti-fascism in a different way.
No, that's
like,
true.
What's that line do you cross? Like, is Charlottesville, I guess we can talk about more of this last week, is Charlottesville a coming out party for the alt-right and the white nationalists, since they all came out with their hoods off and, you know, are now getting outed as neo-Nazis? Or is this a turning point for the anti-fascist movement within this country, or pretty much your anti-fascist movement, not Antifa in particular,
no,
but
your
anti-fascist movement, where people are like, no, we got to stop this now.
Well, you know, this will be my preview of some of the things that are going through my head. We'll see. I mean, again, between now and next week, I'm sure that, you know, we're probably going to have another nuclear war threat, and there's going to be who knows what else is going to happen. Venezuela will be attacking our borders or something. Who knows? But is that one of the things that concerns me about this, right, is that if you look at some of the responses on the right, some of the things that Trump says is that it's emboldening a lot of these folks. And the fact that Trump kind of coined the term the alt-left, right, basically want to start tying some of what they are calling the violence on the left with the broad-based movement against Trump, right? That's concerning to me. I agree with what you're saying. We see some possibilities and some hope here, but I also think that there's some, you know, we got some dangerous roads to walk before we get there.
yeah, it's definitely going to be it's going to be interesting watching this, unfold in the coming weeks and months. There's just a lot on my mind with this, but the responses from the communities. I mean, you saw Lancaster had over 1,000 people show up. Carlisle, Pennsylvania had over 500 people show up last night. Thousands of people showed up in Philadelphia the day before, or last night, and the night before a couple thousand showed up, the night of the Charlottesville, that battle happening. I think there's a lot more people taking it seriously now that, no, we have to nip this in the bud.
Yep.
If we don't, there's a chance it will manifest into something greater and larger.
No, I hear you, man. Well, we will get into this even more deeply next week. I'm glad Sean was able to come on and talk a little bit about this, because it's been on both our minds quite a bit, as it has, I know, with most of you out there. So, but we want to kind of dig in a little bit more deeply next week, kind of look at, what's happened in the time that's passed since Charlottesville last weekend to the time that Sean gets back here and we start kind of looking forward. So just to kind of not wrap us out on that reflective place, but, to look back at kind of some of the fun stuff you went out there, for today's last call, Sean, I have to, say you've partaken in your share of that most delicious beverage that is out there on the left coast.
Yeah, there was not. I haven't been to a lot of breweries I wanted to get to, but I hit some big ones off, crossed some big ones off the list. Russian River had 21 beer flight there.
Well, Russian River didn't have it. You did.
They offered.
You had it.
It was a 21 beer flight, 21 samples of all their beers on tap. So it was like 11 English style or like California style beers. So IPAs, pale ales, bitters, that for 10 Belgian style beers. So a couple of blondes in there, a table beer, but then also a bunch of different sours that they had on tap, which were freaking phenomenal.
Awesome, man.
The place I'm staying at right now has a shuttle service, so just basically drive, get I don't have to pay for Uber. I got a free shuttle service and just go around town getting drunk and can you come pick me up, take me back to the hotel, thanks. But my niece is out here on a trip with us. She's been phenomenally great.
Has she been great? I was gonna ask you about that. She's doing good.
She's starting to talk a little bit.
Oh man.
She can say hi, hello, and stuff like that. And she's fun. She knows she's the center of attention.
She did well on the plane and everything?
Oh, she didn't even cry once on the plane.
Oh my God. That's awesome. That's so great.
Yeah. So, so she was good. It's been fun. One of the observations I got to make, final observations out here in California, not too many pot dispensaries around.
I'm sorry about that, Sean.
I've abstained from that on this vacation, but last year in Colorado, they were pretty prevalent and not like Wild West unregulated, but like they were pretty. It seems like California has more of a control on that. Some of your resort areas, your tourist destinations and stuff like that.
No. I think, Colorado, Colorado and Oregon have been out kind of in the forefront of that too as well. So you have a much deeper, deeply developed system on that in terms, especially how it got rolled out. But that's for sure. Well, we have on my end of things out of here, we've got some cool news today. I'm psyched about the Free Will Brewing today at 3:00. They are going to be releasing Chasing the Dragon in cans, 16-ounce cans. 4-packs are available. There's a 1-case limit, but that comes in at 11.2% alcohol. And this actually has been one of my favorite beers that Free Will has produced. It is super hoppy. They've been getting a little hating on their website, in part because they're getting bigger. They're like, Chasing the Dragon, that's really inappropriate given the opioid crisis and things like this. I'm like, okay, fair criticism, whatever like this. But it has been around for a while since Free Will started. And the idea is to kind of have the most kind of like hoppy, like, you know, the IPA that you will never forget, right? And they've had it on tap. They've never canned it or bottled it up until now. But so I'll be picking some of that up at 3 o'clock today, and some will be for you, Sean.
Like 60 IBUs or something like that, something crazy.
Yeah,
like the IBUs are like through the friggin' roof.
Yeah, it's nuts, man. It's what is it, 1805 or something like this? I think is that. Does that sound right? I'm trying to look at the
180 IBUs.
Oh yeah, 180.5. Yep, 180.5.
Yeah, like it's something extremely ridiculous.
Yeah,
that's been one of their first triple IPAs that they've had. I still remember going there when they were like inside the basement. And you had like the barber stool to stand on.
Yeah, that was one of my first growlers I ever got from that place, was Chasing the Dragon, right? I love that. So, so that'll be the today. So, folks, if you're around in the Perkasie area, Free Will Brewing will have that. One other announcement on Free Will. They're kind of basically closing out the summer with a bang. On August 27th, they will have a Sour Sunday number 4. Right. And that will be at 12 p.m. at Free Will. It begins at 12 p.m. at Free Will Brewing. Their Sour Sundays are awesome. So if you can get out there, it's great. It runs from 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. And again, Free Will Brewing Company is at 410 East Walnut Street in Perkasie, PA. Their sours are fantastic. The new sour guy is just doing a bang up job. I'm sorry. What'd you say?
So I got some good Pizza Boy news too.
Oh, you do? Do tell.
I've been following on Facebook, you know, I follow their social media. Their IPA that I absolutely love was canned this past
week. You're breaking up. Glitter. Wait, you're breaking up. Start again.
Okay, so Spandex Glitter and Egos. I love a lot. They just canned it. They're sending a bunch to Philadelphia. Origlio is going to be wholesaling it, so keep an eye out down there. In-house, they have Spandex Glitter and Amigos, which is their IPA with limes and jalapenos in it. That should be pretty good, and that's going to be on tap. I'm looking forward to try that when I get back. And they also did another of their legendary IPAs, and this time they did it with orange.
Nice.
So it's an orange IPA that's going to be coming out. Orange, lemon sugar, milk sugar IPA.
Oh man. So I hope that basically we're going to get an actual taste test report for you for next week when you're back here, back in PA, back on the East Coast. And so we kind of get back to it. So Sean, man, I'm so glad we could make this happen today. And I know you've got a big day ahead of you here and that you got to kind of get rolling pretty soon, but enjoy the rest of your time in Cali and have a safe trip back.
I will. I'm looking forward to next week.
All right, man. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We are out of here for today. We're going to lead you out with this. See ya!
We're going out where I belong. When the days are short and the light.